тюремный. Третий срок тюремный.
На Майдан! За нашу свободу! За нашу Украину!
It's an uprising fueled by the young. It features an odd alliance of nationalists and pro-Western liberals. It's taken to the streets in unprecedented numbers and has baffled the regime with its mastery of social media. Its goals are to replace a corrupt authoritarian regime with a more pluralistic and inclusive political system. Wait, are we talking about Russia or about Ukraine? Or are we talking about both? Are Bolotnaya and the Euromaidan actually two sides of the same incomplete post-Soviet revolution? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And joining us also via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean.
Hi, guys.
On the blog this week, I noted what I thought was a very amusing tweet out of Ukraine. It was an image posted by a Euromaidan activist showing a mock-up of a video game screen. And the text on the screen read as follows. If you were born in Russia or Ukraine, then you have chosen the most difficult level of play. But the Russians are still at the first stage, while we're already wiping out the last big boss. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who's been relentlessly promoting the Ukrainian protesters on his blog and Twitter feed, approvingly retweeted this image and wrote, "Haha, отлично." Oh, haha, that's great. Now, I thought this was interesting for a number of reasons. It suggested that the Ukrainian uprising and the on-again, off-again Russian protest movement, they're going to be on the streets again Sunday, by the way, were two parts of the same game or the same revolution, if you will, same incomplete revolution, if you will. The video game metaphor pointed to the fact that it's the young, the post-Soviet generation that's providing the energy in both Russia and Ukraine. And the message that Russia's on stage one and Ukraine is on the final stage, a bit of bravado out of Kyiv to be sure, also pointed to an indisputable fact that the Ukrainian street right now looks much farther along than its Russian counterpart. In a thought-provoking piece in Gazeta Ru this week, political analyst Andrei Kolesnikov had similar ideas, and he said, quote, what's happening in Kyiv is not strictly even a Ukrainian revolution or simply a continuation of the events of 2004, meaning the Orange Revolution. It's a continuation of the events of the late 1980s. It's the still ongoing perestroika. He continues, the empire is still disintegrating. It's a long, multi-step, multi-stage process. Mark, your thoughts?
Well, I suppose to start off with, it's worth noting, firstly, that all states are transitional. Everyone is changing. All revolutions essentially are driven by the young. Liberalism, nationalism often connect. So, you know, on one hand, one could say, look, steady on. There's nothing particularly dramatic here. But I definitely think you've hit on something. A couple of points, really. Both in their own ways, Ukraine and Russia are hybrid regimes which have the forms of democracy, but behind that a sort of deep-rooted, elite-driven authoritarianism. We called it the deep state, particularly when we've been talking about Russia. But obviously working in rather different ways. The Ukrainian one has always been rather more shallow, and particularly since the Orange Revolution, rather less sort of deeply entrenched. But particularly it's at this point that actually the most dangerous point for a deep state is precisely when it comes out of the depths and into the shallows. We saw that with Russia, with the castling in which, you know, Medvedev and Putin swapped their roles again. That sense that broke the social contract and that galvanized the protest movement. Well, likewise, I mean, Yanukovych's decision at the last minute just to turn around and say, actually, no, we decided we're going to go with Russia rather than the European Union, again, was a sort of a particularly blatant reminder to the people that, in fact, this is still a state that is run by an elite and indeed a small fraction of elite. Of course, what's definitely different about Ukraine is that the oligarchs are much more divided. They're certainly far less supportive of Yanukovych, particularly actually on the European Union issue. The security apparatus is less extensive, less clearly controlled, and frankly less well managed. So, I mean, I think in some ways what Ukraine represents is not necessarily sort of part of the same trajectory. It's almost like part of the same spectrum. You might say if Central Asian authoritarianisms pretending to be democracies are kind of one extreme of the spectrum, and Russia is somewhere near the middle, then Ukraine is at the other extreme of the most vulnerable type of hybrid state. So in a way, it shows a potential future for Russia, rather than, you might say, that we should assume that there's some kind of predestination at work.
Sean, what do you think?
To me, it seems to come down to the question of whether Ukraine and Russia are still post-Soviet societies. If you chart the revolution going on in Ukraine right now and the protest movement in Russia as part of a continuum from the collapse of the Soviet Union or even perestroika, then you suggest that these societies are still post-Soviet. They still have remnants of their Soviet past. The other thing it does is it determines the character of these revolutions by its supposed end. Therefore, Russia and Ukraine will be continually post-Soviet until they meet the aspirations from the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I'm assuming here that aspiration is some kind of European-style liberal democracy. I'm not sure I actually agree with Kolesnikov on this, because I think that the revolutions going on, the revolution in Ukraine and the protest movement in Russia, are reacting to the type of states that came out of the post-Soviet transformation. Putin's Russia, and in many cases the state that's in Ukraine, is really the formation of the process of the revolution and the collapse from 1991. So I don't see this as a continuum, but more a reaction to the type of state that was at the end of the 1990s and the early 2000s. If you want to put these revolutions and this revolution and the protest movement in Russia in a larger context, I think you could easily look around over the last couple of years with the revolutions in the Middle East, the uprisings in Greece, the protest movements in Spain, Occupy Wall Street in the United States. This is really somewhat a reaction to the corruption of really rich elites and the corruption of political elites. This is the one character. Now, originally, the Ukraine revolution came out of a reaction to not signing an EU association agreement, but that quickly changed. I mean, now it's about protesting against the political elites in Ukraine. And in Russia, it's a similar thing, the political elites in Russia, or even the economic elites in Russia. So I would see these as really responding to something that has been settled already out of the post-Soviet transformation.
I think you hit on something important here. That what we're seeing in Ukraine and Russia is in very much in the spirit of the times. And you mentioned Occupy and what's going on in Greece. But I also would say these things aren't mutually exclusive. And you could kind of put this into this post-Soviet context. And you can even broaden it out beyond Ukraine a bit. I mean, let's look at the trajectory of you had the breakup of the Soviet Union in 91. You had the rise of Putin, which Kolesnikov has said at one point was called kind of a post-revolutionary stabilization, a thermidor, if you will. But then he said, goes on to say that turns out not to be the case. But then right in the middle of Putin's thermidor, you have the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. And then you kind of had, you know, the feeling on the part of certainly the Georgian opposition that, you know, it was a little bit of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And Saakashvili was becoming a new permanent elite. But then you had the rise of Ivanishvili in Georgia Dream. So you have kind of Georgia kind of slowly by fits and starts breaking free from its post-Soviet clothes, so to speak. You had the Orange Revolution, the return of Yanukovych, or the reaction of Yanukovych. And now this. So these revolutions seem to me, and I was thinking about this right before this podcast, if you think about the Velvet Revolution in former Czechoslovakia and all of the other revolutions of 1989, most of them were much neater affairs, most of them, where basically the old regime was replaced by a new regime that was moving in the direction and now is in Europe. the Soviet Union always was going to be a lot more complicated than that for a lot of different reasons. And not least of all that it was actually 15 independent countries emerged from that, and they're all going to move at different paces, but they all emerged out of this Soviet political culture. So I think I'm not sure if what my larger point is here, but I think these things are mutual. There's an odd mishmash going on here. Mark, what would you add to that? Do you see anything to that?
I mean, I think there is a problem, and I think definitely sort of I'd agree with Sean's point about, we shouldn't assume that there is this nice kind of Whig history trajectory, that everyone is going to become Western European, because if not, nothing else. Western European doesn't actually mean anything. There's so many differences between it. But let's just dwell on this whole issue of post-Soviet. What does post-Soviet mean? You see, in some ways, I mean, you drew the comparison with what happened in Central Europe, but there, of course, the regime was always essentially an alien imperial force. So that it was a lot easier to identify, and also these were countries that were very sort of quickly welcomed into relatively quickly at different speeds welcomed into a sort of European confraternity. We shouldn't assume that, as it were, Soviet and authoritarianism necessarily should be conflated. There is not much in Moscow that is Soviet. I mean, it would be very different if we were talking about Nizhny Tagil or whatever. But on the other hand, clearly Moscow is an authoritarianism in its own form. It's just a rather more modern, glitzy one. It's a sort of the modern TV and everything else, rather than troops on the streets type of authoritarianism. I mean, so I think if we're thinking in terms of defining revolutions by what they're responding to, there's an element of that of in Ukraine, as Sean has said, that it's about moving from the Europe issue to going against elites. But the irony is that many of the elites probably don't necessarily support Yanukovych. They have their own different sort of agendas at work. Again, for me, the Ukrainian situation is really rather different from the Russian one, in the sense that in Ukraine you have a protest movement that is increasingly becoming characterized by some really sort of quite strong right-wing themes. That's characterized by a sort of an internal struggle between those who want to just essentially see a return to orange revolutionish values and those who want to sort of create something different, even if they're not quite sure what. I mean, in Ukraine, the irony is that although the protesters are far, far more numerous and in many ways disciplined and well organized than, for example, we saw in Russia, when it comes down to it, they are defined just by wanting to change the status quo. There is I'm not sure if there's at all a kind of consensus on what that means. Fine, once you get rid of Yanukovych, and then you have early elections, and maybe you set up your own little local authorities in defiance of the ones that you've taken over. But what is your vision? And I'm not sure that that's there.
Well, I think with Ukraine, there is because the European Union is a very real, tangible goal for Ukrainians. And I think that is kind of a lodestone. But I want, going back to this question of Russia and Ukraine, and again, I'd like to broaden it even farther and include Georgia in this. But outside of Russia, these revolutions in a lot of ways are about getting free from Russian influence as well as much as they are about creating a more pluralistic system inside their countries. Inside of Russia, part of this is about coming to terms with that. I think Navalny's open support of the nationalistic Navalny, the supposedly nationalistic Navalny, is very supportive of the Ukrainian protest movement, which at its core wants to be free of Russian influence. So I think there's two different dynamics going on right here. And maybe these two protest movements can see eye to eye on this issue, no?
Well,
Go ahead, Sean.
In terms of the getting out from under Russian influence, I mean, the reality is that Russia is a huge state with a huge economy that dwarfs both Ukraine and Georgia, as well as any other state around it. Its influence is going to be felt by virtue of its existence. I mean, if you want to put the efforts in Georgia or the efforts in Ukraine to wrestle out from under Russian influence from a post-Soviet process, well, you could also say it's a post-imperial Russia process, mm-hmm. because that wasn't really completed in 1917 as well. So I really think that yeah, the nationalist element in Ukraine is definitely anti-Russian, and you know, Russia's influence is absolutely felt in part by the fact that half the country is a Russian-speaking, dominated, and more orientated towards Russia in the first place. So, you know, it, like I said, it really comes down to if you see these societies as still post-Soviet societies. And I think that the post-Soviet question was settled. It was settled with privatization. It was settled in the type of systems that developed. I mean, yeah, there are hangover issues, and some of the aspirations might be somewhat the same, you know, i.e. some sort of more European-style democracy. But the character and content of both the protest movement in Russia and Ukraine is really a reaction to the post, trying to renegotiate the post-Soviet settlement, mm-hmm. the way power was constructed and the way wealth was distributed and the type of political system that emerged. And so I really think that the post-Soviet era has been over. It's just that we need to start recognizing that it's over and start really understanding, well, what is the character of the types of systems that came out of that transformation?
But don't you think that there is, I mean, whether the post-Soviet era is over depends very much on what we mean, as you pointed out earlier, by post-Soviet. But we are seeing the first post-Soviet generation, and that is measurable. These are people mm-hmm. that have no memory of the Soviet Union, were born after it.
Right.
And I think that, as I wrote in the blog today, I think that is a real driving force, because they have no nostalgia for this. They don't have this point of reference.
And that's another reason why this is more about the end, the type of political system that developed out of the post-Soviet transformation. The fact that the generation that's really pushing forward with these protests have no relationship to the Soviet Union. Their aspirations, the things that they're fighting against, are things that developed, you know, around the turn of the century, more than, say, in the 1990s or the 1980s.
Right, right. And Sean, there's something I wanted to go to you with, since you're the House historian. I mean, I also made this note in the blog that this nationalist liberal alliance, and Mark pointed out in the beginning, this is nothing unusual. This is nothing new, but this does have a kind of precedence in 19th century Europe, doesn't it?
I'd be careful with that, because mm-hmm. Nationalism in the 19th century, the wedding with liberalism, was a very elite movement. This nationalism is a populist manifestation. So I would put this as a far different character. This isn't being controlled, or even the content of what nationalism isn't being defined by an intellectual elite, which you had more in the 19th century. This is, if you want to, the type of nationalism that we're seeing expressed in Ukraine is clearly out of control of any kind of party apparatus, yeah. or any kind of elite control. This is definitely a far more populist nationalism that comes out of the 20th century more than the 19th century.
But if you look at the efforts in Russia to forge a liberal nationalism, and this isn't just Navalny. I mean, there are intellectuals involved, and it's kind of popular right now among intellectuals in Russia to debate this liberal nationalism issue. So you do see an elite effort to kind of forge that, and you have to wonder in Ukraine if this could change a bit. Leonid Rogozin, one of my favorite Russian journalists, had a great piece in the New Republic this week where he made the argument that basically Russophone Ukraine really would do quite well in a European Ukraine, because in Europe the minorities are protected, minority languages are protected, and the social welfare guarantees are great. But if only the Ukrainian nationalists in the West would reach out to them. Do you? And again, this goes back to one of my favorite phrases: can this all evolve into civic patriotism, and then you do have a liberal nationalism in both countries that's comfortable, and each nationalism is comfortable with the other one? Or no? Is that a flight of fancy from optimistic Brian?
I don't know, Mark. You want to tackle this?
Well, I mean, think about the role of the flag. In Ukraine, it's the protesters who are waving Ukrainian flags. It's the protesters who are daubing the colors of the Ukrainian flag on their cheeks. It's also the protesters who are trying to take over the symbols of sort of traditional Ukrainian statehood, Cossacks, priests, and so forth. If you look at Russia, it's very much the other way around. That in fact, yes, there is a nationalism, but it's essentially it's an ethnic nationalism rather than a state nationalism. It doesn't seek to embed itself in history. It's certainly, I mean, you know, there's no question about trying to appropriate the Russian flag. You know, in
although it is
waved
at protests.
It's waved at protests, but it's, you know, but in Ukraine, it is clearly sort of one of the dominant symbols. If you look at the sort of the use of the Russian flag in protests, I mean, you know, it's there amidst red flags and old yellow imperial flags and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, it certainly is not a symbol of the protest.
Which is interesting because that flag, that tricolor Russian flag, when did that come into being? It was during the Perestroika era protests. This was Boris Yeltsin's flag.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I mean, I think sort of almost anything to do with Boris Yeltsin has by now become, you know, thoroughly tarnished. But I mean, so going back to your point, I mean, you know, is there scope for this to become some kind of civic patriotism or whatever? Well, I mean, of course. Ultimately, you know, all these things work themselves out. You know, if we're doing this in 20 years' time, you know, there will be no question where Ukraine and quite possibly Russia fits as part of a European cultural continuum. But in terms of whether at the moment nationalism can comfortably, in Ukraine at least, fit both the Russian and Ukrainian sort of cultural elements and also connect with liberalism, I think that's harder. In many ways, I suspect that nationalism is being used as the default glue that holds what is otherwise a very, very disparate movement together. It brings together, you know, genuine sort of intelligentsia liberals, football fans who probably would not be counted in that particular category, West Ukrainians who are sick of what they see as the sort of the Donetsk mafia, who is deciding everything. People who are just fed up with a status quo that does not meet with their expectations and aspirations in terms of economic opportunities, in terms of opportunities for political discourse and such like. You know, put all that together. Again, it's always handy to have a useful symbol. And the absolute failure of the Yanukovych regime to control either the mimetic or let alone the kinetic sides of this conflict, in other words, the sort of the ideologies and such like. Well, I mean, you know, that has allowed them to take nationalism as theirs. But until that's really defined, what is the shape in terms of the actual borders or in terms of the ideology or in terms of the sort of the beliefs of a future Ukraine, until that's decided, all these things are just simply handy portmanteau notions.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned the Donetsk mafia because Akhmetov, Pinchuk, they're basically supporting the protesters right now. They have sway in Donbass, to say the least, and you have to wonder if, and this again, this point that Leonid Rogozin made, that there is, if you take away the language and national issue, which is again very hard to take that away, but then it's not too much of a flight of fancy that Russian speakers say, we would be better off in a European Ukraine.
They probably would be. I mean, the same way as you look at the Baltic states,
which we never call post-Soviet anymore, by the way.
Exactly, and quite rightly. You know, if you look at the situation of Russians there, that in the 1990s there were all sorts of howls about how badly they were being treated. How many of them decided, well, in that case, I'm going back to Mother Russia? Or did they suddenly realize, actually, being a European with all those opportunities is really rather nice, thank you very much. Yeah. You know, no one wants to ever go back. But the problem is, as it were, at the moment, this is a movement that is still being driven by the west of Ukraine.
Mm.
And it would have to change to become something that could appeal to the east.
Yeah, no, along the lines of the Baltics, I remember when the city of Narva in Estonia, back in 93, if I'm not mistaken, wanted to declare independence from Estonia and join Russia. And then by 1999, when it was pretty evident that that Estonia was headed to the European Union, it was the opposite. Ivan Gurad on the Russian side wanted to join Estonia. And I did a report where I stood on the so-called friendship bridge between Ivan Gurad and Narva and talked to people on both sides. And the gap between the two worlds was mind-blowing. And anybody that saw it would know that the people in Narva had it much, much, much better. Ivan Gurad was kind of a crumbling kind of post-Soviet city, and Narva looked positively European and completely Russian-speaking, I may add. Did anybody want to add anything on this bit before I move on to the next topic?
Yeah, I just wanted to add the relationship between liberalism and nationalism. Now, we have a really clear understanding of what the nationalist elements are, but we're not really clear, at least I'm not very clear, what are the liberal elements are outside of a desire for some sort of democratic process. But we've seen through the last century that nationalists are fully happy to participate in the democratic process. It's only after they gain power does it become problematic. So what is liberal about the nationalism that we're seeing in Ukraine and even the nationalism we're seeing in Russia? I mean, I guess famously said at one point that Navalny likes democracy, but for Russians only.
Yeah, no, that was a memorable quote that I actually recycled a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So, attributing you each time.
Now, yes, I do know that. but you know, will certainly the Russians in Ukraine would be better off in many respects as part of a European community. That I'm pretty sure of. But does that mean that their rights would be secure? Because European states are integrationalist states, right? In France, it's an integrationalist state. In Germany, well, it's far more difficult. You can't really become a citizen unless you're German. So it's a far different type of the nationalism works in people becoming French. So the question is, would Russians in Ukraine who Russian identified would become Ukrainian, and what does that mean exactly is a really an open question.
Well, no, I think in the EU you have very strong protections of minority rights, mm-hmm. including language rights. And I think this is one of the reasons why this issue is not so hot anymore in the Baltics.
Right. But we also see a very, very, very strong growing challenge to that. I mean, look at the hysteria on the Roma throughout Europe.
Right.
You have the rise of kind of populist nationalist parties throughout the continent. So I think this is becoming part of the challenges because of the global pressures of immigration. I mean, I think similarly in Russia is a similar process, which we talked about before. So nationalism has unfortunately come back on the scene throughout the continent with its various different characters. So I think it's a much more touchy and nuanced, needs to be far more nuanced.
It also raises the question of how many countries Ukraine is. I mean, we're talking about whether or not, you know, Russian Ukrainians would have their rights protected in a European Ukraine. Well, their rights, they might well feel, would be even more protected as part of the new EU state of Eastern Ukraine. I mean, look, let's be blunt. I mean, politically speaking, Yanukovych is dead man walking.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we're just talking about what kind of navigation of, you know, through the sort of the collapse of his personal regime mean. Now, you know, it could well be that the deep state manages to reassert itself in a few concessions here, a little bit of repression there or whatever. That's kind of one extreme. It could well be that there are instead going to be early elections and reformist or liberal or democratic, you know, which may or may not all happen to overlap. Parties become dominant and can shape some new political revolution. I don't know what color we've got now, the Chartreuse revolution, whatever. or it could actually be that this thing spirals out of control. Mm-hmm. And, you have sort of already some bizarre statements that have been coming out of the Crimea. the most Muskophile. Element in which also happens to have Russian troops based there. In some ways, once a system starts to crack, potentially speaking, it can really crack in thoroughly systemic ways.
Yeah.
We could well see these kind of issues emerging. I mean, I don't think we're going to see civil war, But on the other hand, we could conceivably see a not quite so smooth velvet revolution leading to a divorce.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not sure this is going to be smooth. And the issue of the deep state in Ukraine, you raised. I mean, Julia Yoffe had a very good piece in the New Republic back in December, where one of the points she made was that in Russia, the economic elite basically serves one master. In Ukraine, the economic elite is more pluralistic, and it basically chooses who the leader is. And it looks to me pretty clear, if you can take that formulation, that the economic this pluralistic economic elite in Ukraine, Yanukovych is not serving any faction of it right now. In fact, he's managed to alienate all the factions of it. So I think the deep state isn't so deep and isn't so entrenched in Ukraine as it is in Russia. What that will mean going forward, I'm not sure. Before we move on to the next section, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about very briefly. And Sean, you raised this about the context this is happening globally with Occupy and all of the other protests going on in the world. And that's, we're in the midst of kind of a global youth rebellion a little bit, right? I mean, we talk on this podcast about the post-Soviet generation, but the post-Soviet generation pretty much overlaps with the younger part of the millennials in the U.S. and in the West. Are we seeing a kind of youth rebellion throughout the world? And is this in what's driving it?
I think absolutely we are. I mean, this generation that's in revolt is also a generation with very few prospects for the future. I mean, youth unemployment throughout many of these places is incredibly high. I mean, I saw a statistic even in the United States, youth unemployment is like 25%. There isn't a secured future that's being put forward by the states in which young people live in. There's a resurgence of kind of – I mean, there's – why we point out a resurgence of nationalism, there's also a resurgence of leftism mm-hmm. in many respects. I mean, in Western Europe, for sure, but also if we include Occupy Wall Street and that. So we see a move towards kind of a radicalism that's looking for some sort of political change. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that this generation, the people who are running the show, right, the elites who are running these governments, regardless of what government it is not putting forward a future scenario where young people will be prosperous. So I do think this is kind of there's a malaise, but also there is a lot of return of kind of a utopian aspirations.
Mm. And you're correct to point out, we're seeing not only the resurgence of nationalism, but of leftism in the West as well. In a few moments, we will shift gears and look at somebody we used to talk about all the time, but who has been uncharacteristically invisible of late. Until this week, that is. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
From the outset, the entire Sochi project was conceived in a way that would not only produce the Olympic Games, but would also enrich a small circle of Putin's close friends.
For months, he seemed to be everywhere. But soon after his impressive second-place finish in the Moscow mayoral election, Alexei Navalny seemed to vanish from the news. He was still tweeting like mad and posting on his blog, but the man who looked like a juggernaut in the fall seemed to politically hibernate in the winter. But over the last couple of weeks, Navalny was back in the headlines. First, his party was denied registration. Then news reports emerged claiming what we have long suspected, that he's been getting a big assist from prominent members of the Russian political and financial elite. And then Navalny came out this week with a detailed report on corruption in the associated with the 2014 Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, which begin next week, that made headlines in Russia and abroad, in which Navalny was referring to in the quote we heard at the beginning of this segment. Sean, what do you think? Was Navalny just kind of resting up for round two?
Well, I'm probably more about exhausted from round one. I mean, he'd gone through a grueling summer of the court cases, the court cases against him, the trial. He went through a mayoral election. It's not surprising that he kind of possibly ran out of gas at some point in the fall. Plus, I think, too, after the mayoral election, there might have been some kind of sitting down and thinking and strategizing, well, where do we go next, right? It really was the culmination of a very busy year for him. And two, perhaps turning his energies and his resources to coming up with this very, very detailed report on Sochi. Also, you have to include the general political kind of hibernation of Russia in the final months of the year. There's no reason to be doing anything because nothing really is going on. So this report might be the first salvo for in the new political season.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think? I think Sean's probably right. Navalny must have been tired and maybe ran out of gas. Has he run out of momentum?
His momentum has almost always depended on basically doing a sort of judo-like flip of attacks or initiatives by others. I mean, he tends to be an opportunist in the sense that...
Although he often provokes those attacks.
Well, yeah, but you might say, but if you look at the sort of the key issues, it's that stuff has come up and then he knows... I mean, obviously, you know, we have to mention, for example, Biryulyeva. As a classic example of one of the times when he did surface, he took something. I mean, in this case, look, you know, he's clearly emboldened by and responding to what's going on in Ukraine. Likewise, the Sochi Olympics come along and he presents this report and this exceedingly glitzy and very fine-looking website with all these various sort of detailed figures,
which is the
so
most
forth.
Detailed thing I've seen on the allegations of corruption in Sochi. Everybody knows it's going on. Everybody talks about it, but he really spelled it out. It was a pretty detailed report.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, a level of detail that, on the one hand, sort of makes you assume that it's accurate, but also makes it almost impossible for outsiders to genuinely check, because clearly if we assume that it's all above board, and I'm sure it is, he clearly has been given access to information.
And we're going to get to that in a minute.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in that respect, and again, it's not a criticism of him, it's just simply, I think, more of a reflection of his style, is that Navalny holds up a mirror. And therefore, if there's not any, you know, in some ways it's another way of saying, you know, well, because the political season is quiet, but you know, if there isn't something suitable for him to reflect... Then he doesn't. And I think that speaks to so far the limitations of Navalny, is that he doesn't seem to have this strategy or momentum of his own.
I think we'll have a big test. Of course, the Moscow Duma elections are coming up, and this is going to be a big test. I also found it interesting that his political party was denied registration. It was denied registration because of basically one of the oldest tricks in the book. Somebody just before he tried to register his party registered another party with the same name. I've been watching this kind of game be played in Russia since the 90s. I remember a Petersburg local election where everybody who was against the governor suddenly got an opponent with the exact same name. So you had two people with the exact same name competing in the same electoral district. Anyway, Navalny's party was denied registration. And that got me thinking, you know, I had always assumed, going back to his speech after his second place finish in Moscow, where he said, I don't want you to, you know, light torches and turn over cars. I know what to do. I assumed some kind of negotiation was going on. I assumed this involved him kind of entering mainstream politics and becoming the kind of sort of approved right-wing figure from the regime. He was going to play his own game in that context in any event, but then boom, his party doesn't get registered, and it's obviously not registered because of one of the oldest dirty tricks in the book, which means somebody's not on board for that. You got to wonder, is this negotiation still going on? Is this just a salvo in this? I know we don't have any answers to this. It's speculation upon supposition, but how'd this look to you guys seeing his party not get registered?
I mean, we did, you know, there was a lot of speculation that perhaps the government or the Putin's regime would include him in some form of fashion and try to co-opt. And of course, as you said, allow him to play his own game, but play that game within certain acceptable parameters. You know, the only thing I could take away from his party not being registered is that perhaps what it is actually reflects the instrumentalism of of Putin and his people, and the sense of, on the one hand, you let Navalny run in the mayoral election because Sobyanin wants this for this mm-hmm. very instrumentalist reason, but that doesn't mean he's going to be part of the larger conversation of or participation in Russian politics. So we're not going to let him say, we're going to do whatever we do this, can do to stifle the preparations for the Moscow City mm-hmm. Duma elections. I think that's what it possibly
where he could be much more dangerous, by the way.
Certainly, I think too, because that will actually, one, it will be a re-examination of how much constituency he has and how much he can translate that constituency in representatives at the city level. And also, by having representatives in the city Duma, you're building a political kind of a more political base.
Yeah, you have an base of operations to
exactly
to go from.
for a long-term kind of run for more influence.
Right.
So yeah.
And if he performs as well in these elections, there are different kinds of elections, but just like for the sake of argument, if he does anywhere near as well as he did in he'll have a sizable faction in the Duma, in the Moscow
sure.
Duma.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, what were your thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we don't obviously know if there were conversations taking place, but if so, they clearly sort of didn't lead anywhere. But I also think it's worth, again, if we link the two parts of this podcast, also wondering about the extent to which Ukraine may well have played a role in terms of changing the kind of calculus at work within the shadowy confines in which actually political decisions finally get made. In the sense that one of the things that has been clear is the role in Ukraine of having opposition leaders, clearly defined opposition leaders who actually have, you know, quite wide constituencies, just a clear sense of some brand recognition. It might well be that there is now that sense of actually, you know, although at the moment, Navalny's quiet, given that, you know, we have a variety of tests ahead of us, given that, this is someone who can go beyond, you know, let's be honest, youth are always revolting. You can take that however you choose. But
not when I was in college in the 80s. Youth are very docile. They're worried about making monies.
Generation.
Yes.
Yeah. But even then, that was just simply a way of rebelling against their ex-hippie parents.
Right.
but anyway, I mean, the point is that if there's a fear that actually Navalny could well use party structures and also coming elections as a way of reaching out beyond that particular sort of obvious constituency, then it becomes a point where actually, well, you know, you don't want to do anything to help him. And, you know, so I think it's a combination of maybe Navalny hasn't been pushing to try and say, hey, I can be bought into the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe he set his price too high. But at the same time, the Kremlin might well be thinking now that actually the risks of having Navalny as a clearly identifiable opposition leader, quote unquote, is a little bit too dangerous in the light of what's been going on in Kiev.
No,
yeah,
go ahead,
can I say something? Yeah, I think what Mark just said needs to be emphasized because we haven't really talked about or even seen what impact what's happening in Ukraine is going to have on the Russian political landscape. And perhaps you can see this is not registering his party as part of that reaction, mm-hmm. as well as you can possibly place the troubles that Doge TV is going through right now
in a
kind of general reaction against the the development of opposition institutions in Russia in reaction to what's going on in Ukraine. It's certainly possible. We're finally seeing, and we'll perhaps see more of this after the Olympics are over, how Russia, the Russian government is going to react to those events going on
right.
next door to it.
And they're also talking about beefing up the foreign agent law. That's one area to include media. And also we're finally seeing Kontaktia fall pretty much under the Kremlin's thumb. I basically my opinion on the Kremlin's attempts to get control of social media, and I hope to be able to blog this in next week, is that it's going to be a game of whack-a-mole because they get Kontakti, something else is going to pop up. It's the nature of social media. So I think they're fighting a losing game there, but they do appear to be reacting to the Ukrainian events this way. Now, the last thing with Navalny, I saved the best for last because I think this is the most interesting thing that's come out. And less because it surprises me, because we always assume there were ties between Navalny and the technocratic, more quote-unquote liberal side of the elite. And particularly with the Alpha Group, Vladimir Ashurov is often used as the link. But Izvestia came out with a piece this week of these emails, supposedly intercepted emails, that just so happened to land on the desk of an editor at Izvestia, which is the most pro-Kremlin daily in the country. Gee, I wonder where they got those emails from. But these emails basically outlining how the Alpha Group's been assisting Navalny, a lot of it with information for his anti-corruption reports, but pointing to the fact that they wanted to make the Alpha-Navalny link. Mark, why now?
Well, again, I think it's a combination of things. One is that as we start to get to the post Sochi era, and I think it's hard to overstate the extent to which I think everyone's been holding their breath,
yeah,
waiting for that. So I think people are beginning to position, and therefore in that context, it's the start of the renewed, you realize Navalny is no better than the rest of us, you know. Mm. He looks young and charismatic, but in fact he's just as dirty. So, you don't need to be going out and protesting. Just stay out of politics, because everyone is filthy within its sort of campaign. On the principle that apathy is always a useful sort of way of maintaining the status quo. Secondly, though, I think it actually also might revolve around a belief that Alpha has actually begun to transgress. It could well be a warning shot
to Alpha.
Yeah, exactly. Saying, look, I think there clearly has been some willingness to accept that people will maintain contacts with a whole variety of different political actors. But there is also sort of a point that, on the hand, there are sort of lines that you mustn't cross. And I think it's clearly a belief that Alpha has crossed that, especially by the passing on of information. And I think the third point I would make is that, there is also an extent to which we mustn't assume also always that there is some single central strategy coming out of the Kremlin. It could well be that one particular agency, one particular individual decided it was time to start pushing. And it could actually, have much more to do with Alpha than to do with Navalny. So again, I think until we see a few more data points, we don't know exactly what's going on. But on the other hand, it is clear that this represents tensions and disagreements within the elite as much as anything else.
It wasn't Izvestia that first made this allegation, actually. It was Yabloko. I believe it was Mitrokhin who brought this out first. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Yavlinsky even mentioned it, that they were referring to Navalny as an oligarchic project. And yep. Referring to his ties to Alpha. So it's coming from different fronts. I've heard speculation that Alpha themselves leaked this, and they're laying down a marker right now. Like we often get into this, we're into supposition upon supposition. Sean, what did you make of all this?
It's possible that within the context of Navalny's, people in the know knew that this report on the part of Navalny was coming out about Sochi, and perhaps this is somewhat of pushback, or at least to try to taint that, he has all this corruption, but he's only revealing the corruption of a certain type of people, where he's aligned with other possibly, equally oligarchic corrupt people. I don't know. There's possible that context, but I think, as Mark said, it certainly shows that there are some sort of kind of fissures within the elite, small cracks that perhaps this leak represents.
Yeah, no, it certainly made some waves. Now, again, we're moving into post-Sochi. Navalny seems to have reared his head again. Back in September, I said on this podcast that, and I think I don't think I got much opposition from anybody. In fact, I think others may have said it as well, that the opposition as such doesn't exist anymore. Now it's all about Navalny's network. And then Navalny seemed to fade into the ether, sort of. And now he's back. Now, we're going into a pretty important year politically. Things are expected. There's expected to be all sorts of kind of fallout after Sochi when things fall into place. We got the Moscow Duma elections coming up. We got the State Duma elections a year after that. And then we're into preparations for the presidential elections. Is Navalny still the opposition? Is it really all about Navalny? Or is this back to the old fractured Russian opposition that's going to look chaotic? We see Parnas splitting, for example. How do you see this? Where are we with Navalny and the opposition? Mark, what do you think?
again, because he didn't institutionalize his situation, you know, I mean, regardless of whether or not you are able to register a party, you can create structures which would allow you to institutionalize. But that's not the kind of thing Navalny did. I think both because it's not something maybe he's interested in, but also in some ways it would limit his freedom of maneuver too. So in some ways, you know, you're absolutely right that there is no such thing as the opposition. There are constellations of individuals and interests that someone like Navalny at the right time and with the right slogan, you know, can cohere. But at the moment, there isn't any kind of a longer term connection than that. I mean, I think it's worth mentioning. I mean, you know, what is the current big issue that's actually able to get protesters to come out onto the streets of Moscow? It's not corruption, it's not LGBT rights, it's not anything like that. It's about the proposed tax on online shopping. you know, that is the big issue.
Well, in fairness, there's a protest scheduled for Sunday, February 2nd, for the Bolotnaya defendants. And yes, I know there is a protest also scheduled on Bolotnaya Ploshit so people can continue to buy their cheap iPads. Which we're going to cover because that's going to be interesting.
I think the thing is at the moment, and again, it goes back to this issue of Navalny essentially kind of responding to the opportunities that arise for him, is that precisely he needs to be given or he needs to acquire something that'll allow him to do that. And it looks as if at the moment it's the mayoral election, the Duma elections, Moscow Duma elections. If something else crops up, then that'll provide sort of grist for his mill too.
There's another important question, too. In the mayoral election, Navalny showed a surprising ability to put together a network, to mobilize a network in the absence of a party or structure. He's got a network. He mobilized it. It got out. It delivered. And it delivered for him. Do you think he'll be able to repeat that to continue to mobilize this network? Or will this network kind of fade out?
Well, he could, but the point is that you might say he doesn't want to have to recreate that network or the process of building that network.
Reactivate.
Each time. What it shows is precisely that there is a massive reservoir of latent dissatisfaction, either with the whole situation or with aspects of it, such that someone like Navalny can activate it. But again, at the moment, it's a kind of an ad hoc process each time.
Mm. Well, Sean, the first word went to Mark, so the last word goes to you.
Yeah, I think it is important to emphasize that Navalny is a reactive figure rather than a proactive one. And as long as he continues his politics according to the rhythms of the elections and the rhythms put forward by the Russian government, he can remobilize his network, but politics based on mobilization is fleeting. In order to really push forward, he needs to really start to institutionalize. Because as you say, the opposition is dead in Russia. Look, the coordinating committee that we all thought was going to be something is gone.
Right.
He's really the only one left. And as far as we know, he's a solitary figure with a network of people. But until he starts developing a real political regime, political kind of base – and that's institutionalized, I don't know if he could really break that glass ceiling that's been put on him. I mean, look, what's happening in Ukraine, though the Maidan is not necessarily represented by the political opposition, there's a strong political opposition that's institutionalized, that's playing a very key role, at least in negotiations of power. And Russia doesn't have even the inkling of that.
Yeah.
And so I think institutions really, really matter. And as long as he remains this kind of reactive politician, he's not going to go really far. His head will burst up and he'll make some waves. But in terms of an everyday kind of political impact that builds a constituency, I don't see it happening.
Well, Russia also certainly doesn't have the reigning world heavyweight boxing champion of the world.
No, it doesn't.
And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. We'll be back next week to talk about the Sochi Olympics, which will be opening next Friday. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galliotti, professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory, a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the enlightening discussion, gentlemen.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
If I could pronounce that properly. I'd also like to thank our superhumanly patient producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.